Hello, and welcome back to the Baseball Trade Values Podcast. My name is Joshua Iverson, and I am the Associate Editor of BaseballTradeValues.com, joined, as always, by founder and owner John Bitzer. John, we're into the season, and that's supposed to be a good thing, right? We're supposed to be thrilled that baseball is back, and, you know, I've been enjoying watching as much as I can, but it seems like we're just getting hit with bad news left and right lately. It's been kind of hard to keep your head up a little bit, right?
Yeah, totally. You know, it makes you wonder. I know we're going to dive into that topic in a bit, but in general, we're seeing a lot of, like, not just major injuries, but little nicks and minor injuries as well. And so that's causing, I think the point you're getting at, which is like, yeah, it's good to have baseball, but man, it's got a lot of guys getting banged up here, which kind of affects your enjoyment of the experience a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah, and then on top of that, there's all the A's nonsense, and there's things popping up every week with, oh, now Shohei Ohtani's the worst person on earth because of this weird home run ball controversy. It's, I don't know, and the jerseys are still a mess. It's been one of the more negative starts to an MLB season that I can remember, and that's saying something with the last few seasons having, you know, the lockout and COVID and... It's been interesting. I hope we're just front loading all of our bad baseball news this
year. And then there's also sort of a slight carryover of the off season, like guys that didn't get signed, like, okay, I'll sign a week into the season for $1 million or whatever is left, you know, because they're just sort of like, I need a job. So that's a little weird, that, you know, it's not necessarily depressing, but it is kind of in a way, because it's still like, you know, these guys are unhappy. So yeah. Okay, get it all the way now.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, there's still plenty to be excited about, and we're going to talk on this episode about some of the good, some of the bad, get into all of it in just a minute here. But first, I wanted to just mention really quick that we are on episode 98 of this very podcast, and that's not something I expected us to necessarily get to a handful of years back when we started this up, and I was, you know, at the time I was having a commute like 30-40 minutes down to ASU's like recording studio rooms basically to record every episode of this every couple weeks. And so we've come a long way since then, and I think we made a lot of improvements since then, and we're coming up on number 100. And what I'm getting at here is I think we're very open to suggestions here on anybody who has anything they'd like to see in episode 100. You know, I think in episode 50 we did a bit of a recap of some of the highlights of BTV, and so maybe we can do something similar there for episode 100. But I just wanted to take a second here to open up for listener kind of feedback and suggestions for what you might want to hear on episode 100 as kind of a little celebration of the podcast so far.
Absolutely. And one thing I've been thinking about is it's often just you and I talking about things, but, you know, if you guys have questions, if you were interested, I think we're quite open to answering questions, doing an AMA thing, or a mailbag thing. Happy to do that too.
Absolutely. And wanted to make sure I mentioned this at the front of the episode instead of, you know, burying it in some of the outro bits at the end. So we'll mention right here, if you do have any suggestions, any questions for a mailbag, AMA, anything like that, shoot us an email at baseballtradevalues@gmail.com or tag us on Twitter at baseballvalues, and we will be sure to hang on to that for episode 100 and hopefully have a fun time there. Today, let's go ahead and start with the bad stuff, I guess. So let's talk those injuries that we mentioned. It's been pretty constant throughout spring training, so I'm not gonna sit here and tell you that I have a list of all of a comprehensive list of all of the injuries this season and rattle them all off for you, but most recently, the highlights, or lowlights, I guess you would say, are Shane Bieber is going to undergo Tommy John surgery. Steven Strider is on the injured list with a UCL injury, and Tommy John is on the table. It's not confirmed yet. And then Yuri Perez undergoing Tommy John surgery as well. To a slightly lesser extent, Anthony Desclafani, season-ending flexor tendon surgery, and Jonathan Loaisiga, UCL surgery as well. Not Tommy John for him, just a different surgery to repair his UCL. And so obviously the big names there, Bieber, Perez, and Strider. It's frustrating at this point, right? Because it's like, what can you do? Like, there's a guy like Bieber where, and I don't in any way mean for us to be, you know, calling this a win or anything like that. Like, we're not getting off on guys getting injured here. That's not what we do on this podcast, and that's just not what we do as baseball fans.
Right.
But there was a pretty clear trend in Bieber's last few seasons, and we got a lot of feedback on where his values were trending as a result. So, you know, his velo was dipping pretty constantly over the last few seasons, and his strikeout rate was decreasing, and that's just not a comforting sign. And even though he was still getting outs at a decent clip, like, there were warning signs here, and there were shoulder injuries, and there were other injured list stints for him over the last few years, and it seemed to kind of be trending in this direction. And we got a lot of feedback from people that said, hey, his value's too low. Look at how good he is. He's still an ace, and he would get more in a trade. And we kind of had to hold back on that and say, there's just a lot to be concerned about here, even if he hasn't gone under the knife or anything yet. And then I distinctly remember we come into this season and we see all these videos of him online, and he's throwing harder, and then he dominates in his first start. And it's like, okay, maybe we dodged one here. You know, maybe he's back. He's back to being Shane Bieber. He figured something out and he's good now. And apparently, no. After that first great start against the A's this year, he felt some soreness, felt it his next time out, and now we've jumped all the way to Tommy John surgery.
Yeah, and his velo went down in the second start as well. So I know we got a ton of comments saying, hey, you guys are too low on Bieber, and a lot of Cleveland fans were like, no way they're going to sell low on that. He needs a lot, you know, he would yield a lot better results, you know, a lot better trade package. And we held kind of firm. The thing is, so, you know, this is largely an automated operation in terms of determining value, but there are pretty clear indicators with injuries, like particularly if you've had sort of an issue in the past, that is by far the best predictor of future injury. So he was out 2 or 3 months in 2023 with elbow inflammation. Hello. And so, like, that didn't magically go away. And I've said this on a previous podcast when the topic came up. It doesn't magically go away. They thought maybe just taking time off and rest and so on would help. And then he thought, okay, I'll go to drive on. Maybe I'll change something in my mechanics that might avoid that. It didn't help. The velo decreases were also kind of a sign. I'm not a pitching expert, but people who are say that is by far the number one indicator. So in other words, we can to some degree model this based on the indicators. And that's what was going on with Bieber. Like, we knew that there was a higher probability of him having a significant injury because it didn't seem like the problem had resolved itself. You know, and then as it turned out, during the offseason, he was not traded. And there were a lot of sort of, you know, there are a lot of comments that say, yeah, the industry sort of, they didn't come out and say it, but no one was touching him because they were all worried about the same thing that we saw. So I don't want to say we're right. I'm just saying that there are now pretty established indicators when somebody is at higher risk, and the industry knows what these indicators are. And so that's why his value was low. And now, unfortunately, he's having surgery. I feel bad for him because it's like the worst possible time. He's in his last year before free agency. You know, it's a lot of it's similar to Brandon Woodruff's injury, where he basically had to take a kind of a 2-year pillow contract just to kind of get him through the rehab and then get him signed for 2025. And so I don't know if Bieber is going to go that route, but I just wanted to say that's why his value was low. From that standpoint, I wasn't surprised. I do feel bad for the guy, though, because it's terrible timing.
Yeah, and I want to clarify that even if we're not necessarily in the industry of predicting injuries, like, we're not going to pretend that we can, that our trade valuation model can say when a guy's going to get injured or how likely they are to be injured or anything like that. But we can read into these very clear inputs and say that teams are going to assess a higher risk to this player compared to others. And that's what we're trying to model, is what level of risk are the teams assessing here, and how is that going to impact the price they pay for a guy like this? You know, if you could have guaranteed that Shane Bieber would be fully healthy for this final year of team control, then yeah, you could maybe even go as far as doubling that value that we had in for him at the start of the season, just because, you know, there's no such thing as actually guaranteeing pitcher health, and that would be the most valuable thing in baseball if it could be guaranteed. But you can't. And so there's a sliding scale to all of this. There's the, you know, normal amount of injury risk, and then going further and further until you get into some of the cases like this. With that in mind, though, when we look at these other two cases, these other two kind of headline cases of significant injury from the past week or two, Strider, you know, nothing concerning in his profile necessarily. I mean, all you can really say is that, yeah, he throws hard. Like, and that's just kind of what's been happening lately is no rhyme or reason. I mean, certainly rhyme or reason. The rhyme or reason is that pitching is bad for you, but kind of across the board, we've seen guys get hurt this year, last year, going back the last handful of years. This is getting a lot of attention right now, but it's not some new crazy epidemic. It's not, oh, all of this is happening because they adjusted the pitch clock by 2 seconds or whatever. Like, this has been a growing issue for the last handful of years that's seemingly coming to a head just because it's all happening at once right now. But Strider, you look at, and he was one of those guys where you would have felt pretty okay, you know, health-wise, you know, as good as you can feel about a pitcher, you would have felt about Strider, I think, coming into this season, just because he's been so good and so durable in his relatively short major league career so far. But he didn't really have any of those warning signs. And then on the complete flip side of that is Yuri Perez, where he's been, I don't want to say babied, but he's been handled very carefully throughout his minor league career and then his rookie season last year, and limiting his innings and times through the order and getting him all the rest that he needs. They even demoted him down to the minor leagues for a stretch last year to kind of monitor those innings. And so theoretically, they did everything right with Yuri Perez, and he still has to go under the knife. And so at a certain point, it becomes it's becoming a bigger problem than baseball can just handle and point to some of these edge cases and say, oh, well, you know, it's because this guy was starting every third day in college. Like, that's no longer a thing that we have here to blame this on. Like, there's a larger issue here that I think baseball is going to have to confront. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if anyone does. And I think a lot of people are arguing about it on Twitter and coming up with a lot of wild explanations for this. And the Mr. Pitching Injury Guru guy is back active on Twitter again. I've seen him popping up in my timeline, which is its own kind of exhausting. But it's unfortunate in a lot of ways, but it's also, you know, at some point something's got to give and something needs to change to prevent this from happening every year, because it stinks that a lot of the best pitchers in baseball won't pitch this year or will miss half the year. You know, we've almost forgotten about Gerrit Cole in all this discussion. Like, he's also out for a good chunk of this season, and he's not totally out of the woods yet on his own. So
yeah,
it's a bummer.
Yeah. And Gerrit Cole was considered one of the most durable of all the, you know, ace pitchers out there. So even he gets sidelined. I'm not saying he's going to need Tommy John surgery yet. We don't know that, but even he is susceptible to some sort of injury risk. Just when you thought, no way, Gerrit Cole is so dominant and so durable, even he can get bit by the bug. I highly recommend Will Carroll's Under the Knife newsletter, because he's a specialist in injuries. And he often makes the point that this is kind of the next frontier for not just baseball, but all of sports, is preventing injuries and getting really smarter about it. And in order to do that, you really have to kind of, you know, really dive under the hood, what's going on biomechanically, you know, really getting into the very minute physical details, you know, because otherwise on the surface, you could just say, all right, well, higher velocity equals higher risk. Yes, that's true, but not for everybody. Or you could say, well, you know, don't pitch guys when they're 12 and 13, because by the time they're 20, like Yuri Perez, then they're going to, you know, you can't say that. That's, I mean, all of that stuff is a concern as well, but there's no sort of simple answer. So anyway, Will Carroll makes the point that, you know, there's a lot of sort of frontier-ish work on smart organizations are looking into, like, how can we prevent this going forward? What's really kind of the, you know, where are the key indicators under the hood that we can sort of use to monitor this? I think the Dodgers are one of the smartest organizations out there that have already sort of looked at all the pitching injuries they've had over the last couple of years. with Walker Buehler and Dustin May and Tony Gonsolin and on and on. So they know that, you know, they can't just keep throwing spaghetti at the wall and keep signing more and more pitchers because we know we're going to lose a few. You know, they're trying to prevent this from happening going forward. So, and others are following suit. So I think it's too early to tell. But I'm hopeful anyway that some of these smart organizations will figure this out.
Yeah. And you can look at the Rays as well. You know, I think Rays and Dodgers are kind of listed 1-2 as the two, like, okay,
yeah,
we're looking at the smart organizations. What are they doing right now that we should be doing instead? But you look at the Rays and they've also been kind of ravaged by these injuries, right? They have Shane Baz and Drew Rasmussen and Jeffrey Springs. Those guys are all out for a good chunk of time here. And they don't have an answer. Like, they're trying to scrap by with Tyler Alexander's in their rotation while they try and figure this out and get their guys healthy.
Yeah. And from a front office and ownership perspective, it's a good investment, right? Because now you look at Cleveland and they're paying Shane Bieber $13.1 million to be exact for zero performance value going forward. Right. So that's a waste of money. If you look at it on paper, it's coldly as that sounds, that's it's hurting teams financially when they have to pay guys and they're sitting on the shelf. So, and the more this happens, the more it's a waste. And so I make this point not to sound cold, but to sound like, okay, this is a business reason why we need to fix this problem, not just a human reason, but that's where it kind of starts to get traction. Again, the Dodgers are a very sort of smart organization, but they also look at it from a business perspective and say, why are we wasting all this money? And, you know, obviously it hurts the competitiveness if they don't have certain pitchers that they thought they would, but it also kind of hurts their bottom line. So all these things together are going to help, hopefully anyway, I'm hopeful, solve the problem or at least make some progress towards it.
Right. And I'm going to hop on a brief soapbox here, and hopefully this is preaching to the choir. You know, I think we have very smart listeners who already know all of this stuff, but if there was some magical cure-all solution, whether that's something that's being touted by some supposed injury expert on Twitter, or whether it's, hey, throw slow, or hey, pitch to contact, like, if any of those were a true solution to this issue, they would have happened by now. They would have been implemented by now, because like you're saying, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. There are hundreds of million dollars on the line that could be saved if a team could figure out pitching injuries, right? Of not just, hey, we lost this guy for the season and now we're paying him this salary for no reason, but they can more confidently make decisions in which star free agents they sign, or, you know, they can improve their team to the extent that they're improving revenues and making the playoffs more often and things like that. Like, there is so much on the line here that if there was some magic solution, it would have been found by now and it would have been implemented, like, no doubt. Like, with how smart some of these front offices are, like, there's no one size fits all here. There's no magic, oh, we just need to do this, and you know, it's a mindset thing, and we just need to stop throwing sliders and blah blah blah. That's none of that is real. Like, think it through for just a moment there, and understand that it's a complex thing with a lot of factors going into it and a lot of, you know, conflicts of interest involved as well, because, you know, maybe it is theoretically better for pitchers to not all throw 100 miles an hour if not all of their bodies can handle it. But there's also the flip side of, you know, I'd rather spend my season on the major league injured list, rehabbing Tommy John surgery, getting my major league salary, trying to throw 100, than I would spend my entire career getting pennies in AAA throwing 88. Like, there's conflicts of interest here, and there's things that need to change to alleviate some of those in order for us to, like, get any substantial improvement here. And none of that is going to come from this magical, oh, you need to lift your elbow up an inch and then magically you'll never get hurt.
So Shane Bieber just spent 3 or 4 months at Driveline over the winter, right? He knew that he had a problem because he was out for 3 months last year with elbow inflammation. So he thought, okay, let me go to a lab, see if they can figure out a better way for me to pitch that will, A, give me more velocity, and or B, prevent me from having to need Tommy John surgery, because I maybe fix something in my mechanics that can solve that. So he spends 3 or 4 months. All the reviews are great. Yeah, look at it. He's throwing harder. And then 2 starts into the season, he's down. So, like, did that help? Apparently not. So even, I don't mean to pick on Driveline because they're great, but even they you know, tried to address the problem, and you know, it's a complicated problem. It's not the easiest thing to fix. So having said that, you know, we mentioned the Dodgers and the Rays are looking into it. Yes, but it's not a simple problem to fix. It's really, you have to dig harder than that to fix it. The other thing I would say is I don't think the other obvious thing is, well, just stop, you know, making them throw hard. I don't think that's going to happen either. Velocity is here to stay because it wins games. It's competitive, you know, pressure, you know, you know, clearly there's a relationship between velocity and effectiveness. You know, Ryan Yarbrough is not going to win a Cy Young Award throwing 88, but Garrett Cole throwing 97, 98 every single start. Yes, he will. So you're not going to, I think, stop the velocity train. You have to figure out how to work with what you have physiologically in order to throw 98 and not get hurt, basically.
Right, right. And one related soapbox of mine, Greg Maddux didn't throw slow. I feel like that always comes up with all of this of, oh, if pitchers were just, you know, coming up like Greg Maddux was and painting the corners and pitching to contact, he got by without velocity. That's a complete revisionist history made up by, and no offense to you for this one, John, but made up by a lot of Little League dads on Twitter that,
hey, that I'm a Little League dad.
Yep. No offense. You're one of the good ones. I swear.
All right.
but yeah, needed to get that off my chest as well. One question I have for you, and I don't think we have an answer to this. I think it's just an interesting talking point related to all of this, is with injuries increasing, you know, do you think logically that increases or decreases the trade value or adjustment that we may need to make there for starting pitching? Because the argument for, you know, this makes starting pitching more valuable is, hey, now everybody needs starting pitching even more because they keep losing their guys. And the guys who are healthy and pitching well, maybe they get an additional premium on them. Well, on the flip side, if I have even less confidence that this guy that I'm going to trade for in July is going to make it to October for me, then maybe I'm not as willing to give up as much, especially, you know, if we're talking like position player prospects or something. So
yeah,
it's possible that the answer is, you know, no net change. And it's just that those two kind of ideals counterbalance each other and we just end up right where we are. But I'm curious to get your thoughts there.
I think watch the market, and that's what we do. We follow the market. So if you look at the last deadline, Lucas Giolito, the Angels overpaid for him. Lance Lynn, Dodgers overpaid for him. You see what they got. They got basically nothing out of either of those guys, but they overpaid in terms of prospect value. So when the market changes, we will change with it. When we have data points that show the market is not going to overpay for pitching anymore, we will respond. We don't have any of that data right now because it's not overpaying. The only thing I would point to is, you know, Blake Snell didn't get a long-term contract. Neither did Jordan Montgomery and others. So maybe there's a little bit of a sense like, I don't want to pay for a 7-year contract for Blake Snell. Okay, that's fair. But it's probably more, you know, in line with, like, in terms of his performance value, not in terms of his injury risk. Those are the only data points I can come up with more recently that says, okay, the industry is going to be a little bit more careful with starting pitchers. I don't think necessarily that's true necessarily of Snell and Montgomery getting shorter term contracts. Might have been sort of another sort of, by the way, it's less risky. Yeah, sure. But that's probably not the, I guess what I'm trying to say, wasn't the primary factor. So what we'll do is, as we always do, is we'll continue to track the market. If the market starts to pay less for starting pitching because they're worried about injury, then our values will go down.
Right. I think you're right to point out that Snell and Montgomery are complete outliers there. You know, you look within the same offseason, yeah, you see the contracts that Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler got, and, you know, the big trade return for Corbin Burns and for Dylan Cease, and those all were more or less exactly in line with the model, right?
Right.
And so in those cases, it didn't seem like there was any concern of increased injury risk for those guys. And you could argue maybe that's a case-by-case kind of a thing with how durable some of those guys have been specifically. But like you said, it's something that we kind of just have to wait and see on. And I could see it going either way. Like, I don't think we're entering this era where, you know, suddenly you're going to be trading a top 100 prospect for Kyle Gibson or Jordan Lyles because you need the innings covered. But I could certainly see things getting more pricey as injuries or as rotations just get kind of ravaged and every contender needs two starters and there's only, you know, five total viable starting pitchers to go around, I could see that leading to a bidding war because, you know, maybe you have more faith in a guy to hold up over the last 3 months of a season than you do trying to trade for him in the offseason and get him through the full year or sign him to a big 5, 6, 7 year long deal and keep him healthy that whole time. So maybe there's that argument of kind of like, it's a little bit like trading for a reliever at the deadline, where if this reliever is having this insane season, maybe you're a little bit more likely to pay a little bit more and say, hey, he's on this hot streak right now. We're just going to let it ride for these last 2 months. Even if we don't think this is how good he is forever, we only need him to be good for these next 2 or 3 months. So maybe it's a similar logic there for starting pitching, or maybe it's the other end, especially looking at some of these bigger names and guys with multiple years of control of teams start to discount that a little bit. So I could definitely see it either way, and I'm interested to see how that plays out this year.
Yeah, the same. And I would also add maybe it might even affect the draft. We know there's a school of thought now where teams don't want to draft high school pitchers because they're way too risky. And that's mostly from a performance standpoint because they don't have the data yet to show how they perform against tougher competition. That data is stronger at the college level, obviously, because if you're throwing for Florida in the SEC every weekend, you know, you've got, and you're a couple of years older, then you have more to work with, right? But if you're a 18-year-old out of high school, there's a huge error bar there, right? So that people, teams have been avoiding drafting high school pitchers for that reason. And then I could sort of, you know, see there's an injury risk component now too, whether high school or college in the draft. You can see, you know, do they throw an easy 95 or is there like a lot of violence in their mechanics in 95? And which one is the riskier one? Well, obviously you would say the latter because, you know, the more violent your motion is, the more likely you're going to mess something up. Whereas the guy throwing easy 95 is probably more of a Garrett Cole type, more durable. So we'll see if that affects things as well. I mean, that's already been the case to some degree. You know, it's usually termed reliever risk. So you know, if you have a guy who can throw 100, like a Ben Joyce, yeah, he's probably a reliever. So that is another factor that I would look at as well in our data.
Yeah, and I think one final point I want to kind of make here is that there's a lot of like generalizations that can be made throughout all of this, but we're in no way saying that any of these are like one size fits all or all encompassing statements or anything like that. Because obviously, you know, these last round of injuries, we have a Garrett Cole who has been kind of the epitome of pitcher health, and like look at how well he's built, and he has like the perfect frame to be throwing high 90s with regularity and durability. And then on the other end of the spectrum is Yuri Perez, who is a string bean and he's 6'7" and weighs probably less than me, and he goes under the knife. And so I think there's a clear temptation to say like, oh, anybody who looks like that and throws hard is a recipe for disaster. And like, I think there's a tendency for that to be the case, but it's certainly not a universal rule or anything like that. It's not anybody who's got the build is going to be able to hold up. Anybody who doesn't have the build is going to fall apart. Like there's plenty of variation here, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on all of the bits and pieces that go into this.
Yeah. Okay. So let's let the experts figure it out. Dodgers and Rays are going to lead the way, and we'll see where they get to.
Right. Related to this, two minor hits I wanted to make. One, I did mention Anthony DeSclafani very briefly. So he was a member of two trades this offseason. He was first in the Robbie Ray trade to the Giants, and then he was included in the Jorge Polanco trade to the Mariners. And what was interesting was both of those trades came through as pretty significant overpays, with DeSclafani playing seemingly a factor there. So we had him in the model at -1.1 for both of those trades. He's making, I believe, $11.5 million this season, and $12 million this season. And from what we saw about him was that he came back from injury last year and was kind of okay, you know, kind of league average-ish pitcher down the stretch, and we didn't have any indications of further injury or anything like that. Well, he got injured in camp, and now he's going to miss the entire 2024 season and some of the 2025 season, and so we're not going back and you know, playing revisionist history ourselves or anything with this, but it kind of helps explain the gap in both of those trades a little bit, if you know, there were additional medical concerns with Desclafani at the time of either one of those trades. And so that's another one of those cases that we've mentioned before where we don't have the medicals themselves. We can't see exactly what these guys look like the teams can when they're making these trades. We're just going off of that publicly available data. And in this case, it seems like there might not have been quite enough there for the model to accurately assess Desclafani. And, you know, obviously unfortunate that he's out for the season and that he's hurt like this, but it kind of explains away some of the questions from, at least a bit of the questions from those two trades and why he was being treated like a completely dead contract when we saw a little bit of value there.
There you go. It's what he was. Basically, they knew it and it wasn't public. So now that it's public, it explains everything. I think that that's the best logical explanation.
Right. And then one other kind of tangentially related news item I wanted to mention here was that Steven Strasburg is officially retiring, finally. We mentioned this on the podcast 6-8 months ago, whenever that was, when it kind of first broke. He was supposed to retire last August, and there were some kind of late disputes over his contract and how much of it he was going to get paid, and it was a messy situation all around with some questionable comments from Nationals ownership and front office about, yeah, we expect him to report to spring training when this guy cannot physically pick up a baseball, let alone throw it in a competitive manner. So at the end of the day, it looks like he's retiring here. He's going to get his full contract owed. There may be some kind of renegotiations with the deferrals here. But at this point, it's outside of the trade value scope because you obviously can't trade a player who has retired. This is just kind of dead money that the Nationals are eating here. And, you know, it's he in many ways has been the face of, you know, 21st century pitcher injuries, just with all of the discourse about him coming up that first season being so great, such a phenom, and the innings limits and being held back from the playoffs and getting hurt anyway, and then kind of putting his whole body out there to get the Nationals to the World Series, and what it did to his arm and to his body after that with his repeated surgeries since then. And so it felt, you know, in kind of a dark way, it feels fitting for him to finally have his situation resolved and be resolving the same week as all of this other injury news is cropping up and making headlines. So just wanted to mention that as well, that and kind of close the book on that story.
Yeah, I mean, just from a doing the right thing standpoint, it was the right thing to do. Glad they worked it out. You know, he needs to get his contract, but he also needs to retire. So, like, you know, that was obvious to everybody. So I'm so glad it worked it out. From a trade value standpoint, obviously, to your point, we can't have him in the system anymore because he's not tradable. So we've basically taken him off the site. And one factor of that is that, you know, one of the things that our subscribers will find valuable is our team rankings and like how much valuation team has. Well, that was a drag. It was like minus 105 on the Nationals. And so you take out that minus 105, suddenly the Nationals are going to go up in terms of, you know, total surplus value of their players. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we've made it through the real yucky stuff, and now we got some more normal trades and transactions to talk about here. Let's start with one that you alluded to earlier, of Jordan Montgomery finally signing. This was reported a couple days before opening day, but he was officially signed by the Arizona Diamondbacks, I believe, the day after opening day. It's a one-year, $25 million deal with an interesting vesting option for the second season. Depends on how many starts Montgomery makes, and it's a vesting player option, so it's very much, you know, leverage for the player. It's for all intents and purposes, it's that same 1 year and then an opt-out type deal, just structured a little bit differently here. He goes to the D-backs, who in spring lost Eduardo Rodriguez to a lat strain, which doesn't seem like it'll take him out too long, but this is just kind of another bullet for them to add in what looks like a pretty solid rotation right now. And like you were saying earlier, this wraps up this quartet of the big Scott Boras guys of Montgomery, Snell, Bellinger, and Chapman, and all of them taking these shorter term deals with opt outs. And they're all going to theoretically, you know, if they all play well enough, they're all going to be hitting the market again next offseason. And we're going to have to wait and see how that impacts the next free agent market. The last kind of interesting wrinkle here before I toss this back to you is the reasoning behind him hanging on and not signing officially until after opening day is to avoid the qualifying offer. So if he had signed before the opening day, then at the end of the year, the D-backs would have been able to drop that qualifying offer, and then he hits the free agent market next offseason and has that hanging over his head and possibly prohibiting him from getting a longer-term deal that he's looking for. So instead, by signing after the season had already began, he's no longer eligible for that QO, and he'll be able to basically just hit reset next season. So in a lot of ways, makes sense. You know, the fit was a little bit surprising when it first dropped, but, you know, this it's a team that certainly could use an extra starting pitcher and looks a lot better now than it did before signing Montgomery, so it makes sense from that standpoint. But it sure looks like not even, you know, even not accounting for taking a one-year deal instead of a 6-7-year deal that he wanted, but even just looking at that one-year deal, it seems like he might have left a little bit of money here on the table, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, given that he is actually one of the more reliable pitchers, and I say that knocking on wood, hoping he stays healthy, you know, because he hasn't really been one of these types that goes down with injury that I can recall. But anyway, so he's got these vesting options in his contract that says he'll get more money and you know, the second-year guarantee will click in after a certain point. You know, all of those are fairly easy thresholds for him to clear based on his history. So, you know, I was looking at that. Well, should we model him as a one-year or a two-year? So logically, because I think he's going to clear that hurdle, I think we need to model him as a two-year. So that's what we did. So on a two-year basis, he's getting basically $50 million over 2 years. So that's $25 million AAV. 2 years in our model was 63 fair value, 63.4. So that's 31.7. So that's fair value in a sort of a neutral sort of ish market. So it's a little bit of a bargain for the Diamondbacks. I think it looks good for them. Now, the overarching sort of point here is that the climate changed, obviously, and it does tend to do that. But this is really the first year we've run this sort of free agent model. And we definitely saw a pattern of if not overpaying a little bit early, at least fair pay, fair to slightly higher through the early and middle periods. And then the last period of the offseason was just totally a musical chairs game. Hey, I got to get a job. I'm just going to sign for whatever I can. You saw that with Snell. You saw that with Montgomery. You saw that with Chapman. These are all Boris guys who kind of waited too long. You saw that with Bellinger, kind of over sort of playing their hand. But you also saw it with guys like Gio Urshela and Tim Anderson and, you know, Michael A. Taylor. All these guys, Lorenzen and J.D. Martinez, they signed for a little bit less than you might have thought because at that point they just needed a job. So there was a little bit of that in Jordan Montgomery's situation. The other thing I would point out is you never know where they're going to end up because sometimes teams are not going to disclose their strategy or play their hand publicly. So what I mean by this, there was a lot of rumors from a lot of journalists. Okay, it's the Rangers versus the Red Sox. The Red Sox are into it, and it turns out after the fact, no, they never were. Like, if I had any hair, I would tear it out because like so many people are putting stock into what, you know, some of the national journalists say, like, oh, you know, and there were so many articles about Jordan Montgomery. Where is he going to end up? Is it the Rangers or the Red Sox? And he ends up with the Diamondbacks, who came out of nowhere at the last minute. And partly that's because Eduardo Rodriguez, who they had signed earlier, had an injury. Doesn't seem to be as major as some of the others, but nonetheless, they could use another arm because of that. So anyway, my point is, I don't want to be one of these negative Nellies and say, yeah, don't trust anything you read in the media, but I do want to say it's not as simple as that. You can't just say, assume he's going to go to the Rangers or Red Sox. It just never, I shouldn't say never, but it often doesn't work out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. The one of the things that baffles me about this all, on, you know, looking in hindsight here, and I think you're right, and I think Montgomery kind of landing with an unexpected team here, you know, obviously this is not what anybody planned. But when you just look back at kind of the course of the last few months and you see that Bellinger ends up going back to the Cubs, which, okay, he signed, I believe, early spring. So, not as much of an impact to the start of his season there. But then you look at Chapman and Snell signing mid-spring, late spring with the Giants. Like, everyone kind of expected that, right? Like, what happened here? Like, and this is where I think it does... I don't know. I think there's mutual blame to go around here for exactly how these scenarios were handled, because it's not beneficial to the team or to the player to have a guy starting that late. And so some concession should have been made on probably both sides to get this all taken care of a lot sooner than it did. And I hope people are learning from this and we don't see this in the future, and whether that's on Scott Boras' side or on the team side. And it almost reminds me of the old qualifying offer system and the stalemate with guys like Steven Drew and Kendrys Morales waiting until after the draft to sign so that they wouldn't have to be dealing with the draft pick compensation. And every one of those guys, their season was kind of just a disaster. Like, they would be doing all they could to stay in shape, but then they wouldn't sign until after the draft in June, and they just couldn't get it going that following season, and it really affected a lot of guys' careers, I think. So I don't want to be as dramatic. I don't mean to be as dramatic here. You know, I don't think just a slower start to the season, a slower ramp up, whatever, is going to torch Blake Snell's career or Jordan Montgomery's career. Like, I think these guys are going to be fine. It's no different than if, whoops, they tweaked their hamstring on day one of pitchers and catchers reporting, so they're like 3 weeks behind everyone else. Like, it's no different from that. So I don't mean to make some big story out of this, but it's certainly not ideal. And I just hope everyone learns from this for next time around, and we can actually get all our players signed in the off season, as opposed to as opening day is passing.
Yeah, totally. And I should mention, you know, there was that kerfuffle between the MLB Players Association and, you know, their representation, and they're mad, basically. Because you look at it from their point of view, I mean, Matt Chapman, for example, waited 6+ years to finally hit free agency, and he thought he was going to get a big bag of money, and he didn't. Same with some of the other guys. And so, like, and that has a trickle effect on the rest of the community of players. So now they're all thinking, oh my gosh, what am I waiting for with free agency if I'm not going to get paid like I thought I would? It's not the bag of gold or the bucket of gold that I thought it would be. And it's a little more complicated than that, and I can't count on it. So I think we're going to see more of those sort of angry rumblings. The other effect of that is you might see more extensions, because they figured, well, why wait? I'm just going to get some money now. Yeah, I think there's a lot of dynamics at play here because of that.
The way all of this is trending is concerning. And just kind of looking at everything, and I know I said we're done with the doom and gloom of the episode, but I lied. We're only, you know, like halfway or so through the current CBA, and we all remember how much fun it was when they were publicly arguing, litigating the CBA, and the owners locked out the players for a whole off season.
Yeah.
Well, it really seems like between the injuries and the pitch clock and all of that debate, between this free agency issue, between, you know, the betting scandals, the uniforms, like all of this discourse, and to stack on top of that, some of what's been reported the last couple months about the leadership problems within the MLB Players Union, it doesn't seem like the next round of CBA negotiations is going to be much more fun. I'll put it that way. So current CBA goes until December 2026, and we're going to need some significant changes between these two sides, and significant, you know, coming together, working together towards some solutions. Otherwise, I think we might be headed for another lengthy break from baseball when we get around to late 2026.
Yeah, and I don't want to dwell too much on this either, but I just want to point out, we run a trade value website and a larger sense of valuation website, right? And we're seeing trends on how much players are getting paid, because surplus value is really just like what are you worth minus what you're getting paid and the differences. So another way to look at that is, if I have more surplus value, means I'm getting paid less than I'm worth even more. And so teams obviously want to optimize in ownership. They come from the business world typically, and they know about bottom lines. They know about like squeezing every penny. So they're trying to basically say, how can we have a winning team in a longer term sense by not overpaying for players. And that's why you see a trend towards making the most out of the younger players they have. Everything's skewing younger because they're cheaper, because they're under control for 6 years, and especially the pre-arb ones. And to some degree, they will extend that window, but still keep that surplus value in the extensions that they give. So in other words, they're really often, they're looking at it from a bang from a buck perspective, right? And so that's, and the players are noticing this more and more. And so they're not going to pay retail as much. Owners don't want to pay retail, or God forbid, overpay retail price for expensive free agents, especially when they get into their 30s. So this is all, to your point, this is all heading towards a major, you know, renegotiation, if you will, in a couple of years, because the trend is clear from the team's perspective. They're skewing younger, they're skewing cheaper. And the players are like, ah, what do we do? I want my money. I thought I was going to get my money. Now what's happening? So that's a big argument. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and it's like we've said in the past where, you know, the previous round of CBA negotiations, the players did well in a lot of areas and made a lot of kind of much needed improvements to the pay structure. But at the end of the day, the system still fundamentally, structurally, it pays the players the least when they're worth the most, right? It, for the first 6 years of a player's career, they're not going to earn what they are quote unquote worth in field value. And those are also the six most valuable years of their career. They're the youngest, you know, the prime years of their career. And so what you have is a lot of guys like you said, Matt Chapman. He's worked really hard for 6 years, had a lot of very, very valuable seasons within those first 6 years of his quote unquote team control, where he might have been a 5 or 6 win player. And on a field value perspective, might have been worth $30, $40 million. But at the time, he was paid either, you know, his $500,000 major league minimum or his $5 million arbitration salary or whatever. And now he's hitting the free agent market and saying, look at how good of a player I've been. I deserve to be compensated. And, you know, the teams, like you said, are just looking at the reality of it and saying, well, you're on the wrong side of 30 now and you're in decline and we can't pay you like the player you were. We have to pay you like the player you are and you are going to be going forward. And that's where the disconnect is. And none of this is new to anybody. Like, we've all known this, but it seems like it's, like you're saying, like it's coming to a head here. The, you know, more creative teams get and the more they emphasize the young talent and the more the RSN structure of all of this and that revenue structure falls apart, the more they're going to continue to really think hard about every dollar that they do spend in free agency and whether it would just be better spent going toward a rookie on a major league minimum contract who can replicate half the production and let's find the other half of that somewhere else. So it's all fundamental to the salary structure of the sport. And I don't know if we're ever going to see that just completely get torn down and revamped, or if it's as simple as, well, get to free agency a year sooner or start arbitration a year sooner or whatever. Like, there's different permutations of this that were widely discussed in the last CBA negotiations and just didn't happen because of the hard line stance the owners were taking there. And, you know, maybe if the players held out another month or two and let it really impact the season itself and really hit the owners' pockets that way, maybe they could have gotten one of these concessions. But at that time, they weren't willing to. At least the trajectory we're on right now, it seems like we might have a different story this next time around. So still a couple years, but buckle up.
I think they skirted it in the last negotiation. I think, you know, it came up and that kind of delayed things, but at the end of the day, it was a compromise. You know, it should not go unmentioned that the players were not happy with the result. It was basically brokered by their representatives who said, look, let's just compromise. Let's make a deal. Clock was running. You know, so I saw a lot of reports that said, hey, wait a second, I'm not happy with that. Like, the most of the players anyway. So, like, okay, so basically they kicked the can down the road from the player's perspective and said, we need to deal with this because we didn't really the last time. So we got to deal with it the next time. So I think it's coming.
Right. Wasn't it that the, like, player executive committee, you know, the Max Scherzer, Lindor, the rest of them voted against the deal, and but the rest of the player contingent approved it?
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
So there's, from the people, you know, most directly involved in these litigations, there still wasn't unanimous approval or anything close to it. This last time, it was just kind of the greater population saying we want to go play, which is always going to be kind of in the back of people's minds during these negotiations and you know, the public image of it all. And I can't tell you how many people just casually would be like, oh, the baseball players are striking, and I'd have to be like, well, that's not exactly it. It's a lockout. It's different, and usually people don't want to hear the full explanation there. So there's a real like public perception impact of all of this stuff that the players certainly have in mind. And yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. This is a tangent, obviously. we're still a couple years off from this actually being a present concern, but just something that's not comforting me as I look at all of these news stories that have popped up in the last handful of months.
Josh, it's all doom and gloom, man. We need to lighten this up.
All right, let's do it. Let's lighten it up by talking about how great our free agent model did. Do you want to dig into that and some of the early results here from our first off season of having this model publicly available?
Yeah, so this is one of the new features on the site. If you subscribe at the GM level, you can see free agent estimates, and you can toggle between years. So you can say, what would he get for 5 years? What would he get for 10 years? And you'll see different AAVs pop up as a result. Obviously, the longer the contract, the more risk is involved. So it's different than a typical other site to say, oh, I think this year, this guy's going to sign for $10 million at 325 with the Yankees. I'm making this up. But we're not in that prediction business per se. We're in the sort of what is he worth over time perspective based on this model this year, this length and that length. So when they did sign a contract, he said, okay, Aaron Nola signs for 7 years, 172. And that's... so then we just sort of model that as a 7-year deal. What would it be in our, you know, compare the reality to what we had, and we see out the difference. The one thing that I noted in the article is that you can do it on an unweighted basis, which is basically the average AAV, regardless of the length, or you can do it on a weighted basis. The thought being that the longer the contract, the more weight it should carry, because they took more risk and spent more money on it. So we did both. On an unweighted basis, so our goal was to be plus or minus 20%, which is how we do our trade model. If you notice the range of low to high, it's always plus or minus 20%. So on an unweighted basis, we were at 19.9%. On a weighted basis, we were at 16.3%. In other words, we're weighting the longer deals, the 7-year deals, more than the 1-year deals. And so that looks, you know, it's a good start, I would say. Did we nail it? Not perfectly, no. But did we come close? Yeah, we did. And there were a lot of big wins. We talked about that in one of the sections of the article. We were dead on the money on Jaime Candelario and Mitch Garver, and right very close on Jack Flaherty and Harrison Bader and Frankie Montas, Jorge Soler, Sonny Gray, Luis Severino, Michael Wacha, Lucas Giolito. Those were all good. And then we were close enough, I'll say, on Nola, Kenta Maeda, Josh Hader, Aroldis Chapman, Blake Snell, JT Martinez. And then there was, so in other words, this is the typical sort of arc. We're going to get a lot of them right. We're going to be close on some. We're going to be close enough on some others. And then there's sort of a mid-range category. We're like, yeah, it sort of fits. It's between 11 and 20%. You know, Otani's AAV was in there. Sean Manaea, Kevin Kiermaier, Cody Bellinger even was in there. So there's enough of those to say, okay, that's sort of the middle range. And then there were a few misses, as you would expect. So there were some cases where, our model thought Teoscar Hernandez was overpaid, Justin Turner, given his age, was overpaid, Whit Merrifield, given his age, was overpaid. But then you had sort of the late-breaking sort of, we talked about the losing the game of musical chairs, Matt Chapman was underpaid, Michael Lorenzen was underpaid. So you get a few of those as well. So in summary, I think we did very well. We're always going to keep a close eye on trends. One thing that occurred to me is, you know, do we keep it, you know, steady state throughout the whole thing, or do we adjust with the market as we go, knowing that, you know, there may be underpays at the end there like there were this year. So that's one thought. I'm not saying we would do that. But how do you take account of those desperation deals at the end? I mentioned Gio Urshela. I mentioned Ahmed Rosario. So there's a few that are just like, I'm going to take $1 million because I need a job. So there were all those. There were also, it gets complicated also because in some cases there are team options and player options, and there were some cases where the salaries were deferred. The basic example of that is Ohtani, obviously, who deferred $68 million a year, so he had to adjust the AAV for that. But there were some smaller cases as well. Teoscar and JT Martinez, for example, when you looked at the deferrals, they and you calculated the net present value of those deals came in closer. So Last but not least, we did not include the foreign players like Yamamoto or Imanaga because we don't have a way to kind of test them in our model. We're not sophisticated enough to figure out, you know, the competitive level of Japan and Korea and how that translates to America. There are teams who have invested millions of dollars in that. We haven't. So we're just going to ignore those for now. Because what we can do is we can model the domestic ones, but not those. So all in all, I think it was a good start.
Yeah, I agree. When I look at this and kind of the results laid out like this, I don't see anything that's like that's pressing to me, right? You know, there were some misses, mm-hmm. but like you said, those are inevitable. And especially with how strange of an off season it was with the whole Boris scenario and some of these guys signing so late and all of that, like it would almost be more concerning if we were 100% on the money, right? That would be a different concern. But when I look at this table in the article, which again will be linked in the show notes here, but these biggest misses here. Well, I don't mean to just go one by one and excuse all of these guys, but you kind of can. Like, so Matt Chapman, obviously his own situation. That was its own thing. Tyler Malley coming off of injury. We've discussed at length how we don't have the full picture there, and so if you even scroll up to kind of the mid-range chart as well, Liam Hendricks is a similar boat where he's kind of in that injury range of like we don't have the full picture here to evaluate this guy like we do for a guy who is fully healthy, so that can kind of factor in there. And then I think the most interesting thing from this is that it starts with Nick Martinez and ends with Michael Lorenzen. And I think those two are very interesting to compare. I think they're very similar pitchers from a value right. perspective.
Yeah.
And the difference is when they signed. Mm-hmm. The Reds kind of jumped the market to get Nick Martinez and gave him what we considered a pretty substantial overpay by doing 2 years, $26 million. The Rangers hung around, and at the end of the offseason, Michael Lorenzen signs with them for 1 year and $4.5 million. Well, if you gave the Reds the option at the beginning of the offseason, if you give any team the option at the beginning of the offseason, do you want Nick Martinez on 2 years, 26, or Michael Lorenzen on 1 year, $4.5 million? Every team is taking Lorenzen 100 times out of 100. So I think it's just a case of how the offseason played out and how you're always going to see some of these outliers. You know, maybe the Reds just did kind of jump the market and overpay a bit on Martinez. It happens. And I think it's pretty clear that the Rangers got a real discount on Lorenzen because of when he signed and how his market played out. So I don't think either of those cases are necessarily an indicator that there's this massive flaw within the model. I think they're just kind of interesting two sides of the same coin as far as how this offseason played out. And
totally.
I think that the one other point that you could kind of extrapolate from those two and kind of tie it back in with some of these other guys that weren't complete misses but had a little bit of variance there was the Jacob Junis, Seth Lugo, Ronaldo Lopez. You can even mm-hmm. maybe squint and tie Sean Manaea in there, of these like swingman types
mm-hmm.
where you don't know necessarily coming into the offseason whether to model them as a starter or a reliever. And Ronaldo Lopez is kind of the biggest case there because he's been pretty firmly a reliever for the last handful of years, and it was a pretty big surprise to everyone that he was a starter. Versus, you know, a Seth Lugo or a Nick Martinez, where if you've just decided that they're a starter and they're going to make 30 starts for you, then they're inherently more valuable than they would be as a reliever or as a swingman. And so maybe you're more confident handing them that extra few million dollars per year or whatever it is.
Yeah. The other interesting case I thought was, and I didn't necessarily include this, but IKF, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, got two years, $15 million guarantee from the Blue Jays. And is he really all that different from Ahmed Rosario and Gio Urshela, who basically took whatever pickings were left over for $1.5 million? Like, I'm sure you would rather have Gio Urshela at $1.5 million for 1 year versus paying IKF 2 years, $15 million. IKF's never been above 100 WRC+. He's a below-average hitter. Yes, he's versatile as a utility guy, but so is Gio Urshela, and he has had a better bat. Like, why are you overpaying for IKF? I'm sure Blue Jays fans have been asking themselves this question. So that one doesn't sit too well based on, but then, you know, look, these are all human beings. To some degree, there's kind of a gambling mindset. Do I hit now or do I wait, you know? Like, okay, so they decided to pull the trigger on IKF, and then, like, they probably regretted it when they could have had her shell out for 1.5, you know? So there's a little bit of that, too.
Yeah, yeah, it's all musical chairs, hot potato, however you want to call it there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think end of the day, really promising returns. There were a lot of times, like you mentioned, where you would plug a number into the model and say, wow, that was right on, or within, like, a million or two million, and like... That's really impressive stuff, and at especially at a certain point here where you come down to a margin of error where you're talking about, like, tax rates and like bonuses and other, like, you know, hey, maybe Team A was offering me a suite for all 81 home games and Team B was only doing it for 25 or whatever. Like, when you get into some of those smaller numbers, that can be what you're talking about, or just like preference of, you know, location and weather and things like that. So, like, free agency isn't a purely perfect market of, you know, whoever pays the most money gets the guy. There's these other factors that get involved as well that aren't necessarily included in our model. And so we're not necessarily shooting for, okay, it has to be 100% or else it's a failure. Like, there's an error bar here for a reason. And I think a lot of these fall very, very comfortably within that error bar. And just, yeah, I think it was a really solid offseason for us.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, what I think about is we're a guide, right? Like, we're here to answer the question, what would it take to sign Blake Snell? What's fair value, right? Give me a reasonable estimate of that. And I think we did that. That's what we do. And even if, you know, the occasional ones, you know, and most of them are pretty close to the number that we had, right, is what we're saying. And then there's occasional outliers, like, yeah, okay, everybody knows that, you know, Chapman and Snell and Montgomery probably got less than what they could have, you know. So in that sense, I think there's usefulness to it as well. Like, how much was Chapman underpaid, you know, for example. So or Lorenzen or whoever was, you know, a victim of the musical chairs game at the end. So I do think there's value in that. So primarily it's a value as a guide. Like, what would it take to sign this guy? And then if you wait, how much of a bargain are you getting on that guy? And those are basically the two questions we answered here.
Yeah. Well, cool. Anything else you want to touch on there before we move on to some of the other news?
No, we're good.
Sweet. So a handful of minor transactions the last handful of weeks as teams kind of shuffled around their opening day rosters and the DFAs and the subsequent trades. And so a lot of cash considerations type trades that we won't mention here, of just some of these fringe 40-man type guys. But a handful of deals that are worth talking about here. The first one, let's talk about this three-team trade. The Yankees acquired utility man John Birdie, who we had at $4.7 million in surplus. That he comes from the Marlins. The Marlins get outfielder Shane Sasaki at $1.3 million from the Rays, and outfielder John Cruz at $1.9 million from the Yankees in exchange for trading Birdie away. And then the Rays, they sent Sasaki to the Marlins. In exchange, they get catcher Ben Rortvedt at $0.1 million from the Yankees. So, three-team deal. A little bit of a simpler three-team deal than some others we've seen. This one gets accepted by the model. What it came down to was the Yankees did not have a solid utility man, a solid backup infielder after Oswald Peraza started the season on the injured list, and they needed to go out and get somebody. They also had three catchers on their roster between Jose Trevino, Ben Rortvedt, and Austin Wells. And so Rortvedt was the odd man out. He goes to the Rays, who kind of spent most of the spring without a true backup catcher on their team. They were trying out a few different AAA, you know, minor league signing type guys, Alex Jackson, Rob Brantley. They brought back Francisco Mejia, and none of them really claimed that spot. So instead they go out and get Rortvedt. And the Marlins have added a handful of versatile utility infield types. You know, they have Vidal Brujan and Xavier Edwards and Nick Gordon and Tim Anderson they just brought in. And so Birdie was a little bit more expendable to them. So checks off all the boxes for all of these teams. It's perhaps most interesting for the Marlins, just because they've been hit particularly hard by some of the injuries we were talking about earlier, between Yuri Perez and Sixto Sanchez and, or sorry, not Sixto Sanchez, Sandy Alcantara. And Braxton Garrett has been slow to start the season. And they've just been, I believe, as of the time of recording this on Sunday early afternoon Eastern time, I believe the Marlins are still winless on the season, which is not what you're looking for. Yeah, they're 0-9. That's not good. So there's already some discussion about whether they might be trending in the selling direction. And obviously this trade was made well before that 0-9 even happened. I believe this was right before opening day that this trade went through. But they are a team to watch early on here. You know, do we start to get some early season rumors about a Jesus Luzardo or a Luis Arraez or any of those other guys on that roster? Just one storyline I'm keeping an eye on early this season.
I think there's a lot to unpack here with this. First of all, I really like this trade from every team's perspective. They all got what they need. It's pretty much a fair deal across the board. But I think there's a few things to look at. Well, number one is Rortvedt was out of options, which is why I think the Yankees, you know, felt he was expendable. I think they want to invest more in Austin Wells. They trust Trevino. They don't have the roster space to carry a guy, a third catcher who's out of options, and so it makes sense for them. DJ LeMahieu is often on the IL, so he's another infielder that they need to replace. John Birdie is a veteran. They like veterans when they're just going to plug and play there. From the Marlins' perspective, they don't need Birdie because he's in his 30s. What they need is kind of skewing younger. And oh, by the way, Peter Bendix came from the Rays. And so when he's getting a prospect from the Rays, he's getting a guy who he actually scouted and knows. So that makes perfect sense from the Marlins' point of view. From the Rays' point of view, they get their backup catcher. Rortvedt, you could possibly argue, was undervalued here, largely because he was out of options and also because he hasn't really done much. But maybe he will sort of raise his stock given playing time in Tampa. The other thing I would sort of point out is, you know, from the Marlins' perspective, they're off to a bad start. I don't think they're worried about that necessarily because I think the whole strategy was to skew younger, to skew cheaper, to go more long-term. So Peter Bendix, ever since he started, has been kind of rebuilding infrastructure, kind of setting the table for longer-term success. He's more worried about, in other words, he's not worried about short-term success. He's more focused on long-term. So it's another one of these cases of sustainability, right? Of sustainable competitiveness or whatever the phrase is. So he's more concerned about, you know, longer term, basically building the Southern Florida version of the Rays, basically, instead of, you know, trying to go for a short term win. We know they're in the playoffs last year. He basically said, that's not sustainable. I'm going to just trade off veterans and skew young. So I think everybody gets what they needed out of this.
Yeah, definitely. It's a tidy little trade. Let's put it that way. the Marlins side of it has gotten some not the Marlins side of the trade, but the Marlins in general have gotten some flack just because of the optics of firing Kim Ng and then, or not firing Kim Ng, but reportedly kind of shortchanging her and trying to hire someone over her and everything that happened there. And then they get off to this terrible start. Obviously, it's still very early. We've seen much better teams get off to much worse starts and much worse teams get off to incredible starts. So I don't want to make too much out of 9 games, but the optics aren't great over there. I think the vibes aren't great in Miami right now.
No, and I feel for the Miami fans because they were like, oh, we're getting good. Oh, no, now we're rebuilding again. You know, it's just like, ugh.
Yep. Sticking with the Yankees briefly, and I know I mentioned we're you know, I would be passing up on most of these cash considerations type trades, but I was interested. They acquired right-handed pitcher JT Brubacher from the Pirates. They actually got Brubacher and international pool space for a player to be named later. And Brubacher, we actually had at 3.3 in surplus, so a little bit higher than the typical, you know, roster fodder type trade. And the reason for some of the discrepancy here and the reason they were able to acquire him is because he's rehabbing Tommy John surgery. He's targeting midseason for a return. He missed the entire 2023 season. And by no means is he a superstar or anything. He's probably, especially coming back from Tommy John, it's probably best to project him as like a swingman type. But he was effective in 2022, his last season of pitching. You know, 28 starts with a 4.69 ERA, 1.9 FWAR. Like, That's a viable big league pitcher. That's kind of in that, Adrian Hauser territory of like, you're never going to complain about having this guy as your number five. You could do better, but he's going to pick up the ball and put you in a position to win at least a decent percentage of the time. And so it was curious to me that the Yankees were able to acquire this guy basically for nothing. And there's a possibility that this player to be named later ends up being somebody of, that 2 to 3 range of value. So the book's not closed on this one yet, but I thought this was an interesting trade. And he's making a little bit of money here. He's in his second year of arbitration. He's making $2.275 million. And if he comes back and pitches well and they decide to keep him, that would bump up again next year in his final year of arbitration. And so that's likely a factor as well, that the Pirates just saving a couple bucks here. But I thought this was a smart pickup by the Yankees. I think he could be nice second half reinforcements for them.
Yeah, it's a thinking ahead trade. It's like, okay, we'll wait for you till you're done. I do think the PTBNL is going to be, a little bit more of a prospect than just your typical sort of bottom of the roster kind of guy, given the values. We could be wrong, but it feels like, because, they're getting two pieces. They're getting Brubaker and the international pool space, and that tends to raise an eyebrow and say, yeah, this is a little bit more of a prospect. So I feel good about the 3.8 total. We add the 3.3, and I'm estimating the international pool space at 0.5. I could be wrong about that. We don't really have a model for that. I know they have $250,000 increments. It wasn't reported as far as I know exactly. I think there at one point it was 550, but that doesn't make any sense. So I'm just using 0.5 based on what we know as reported. So anyway, let's call it 3.8. So the value of the prospect is possibly in that range.
Yeah, and I think a large part of why you can feel confident that it's going to be at least some level of value in this player to be named later is that there was no like imperative for the Pirates to make this trade. They didn't have any pressure. It wasn't a 40-man crunch or anything because Brubaker is on the 60-day injured list, which means he's not on the 40-man. So unless it was some sort of, hey, we don't like how his rehab is going, or hey, we need to save a couple bucks here. We're a little over budget to start the season. Unless it was something like that, then there was no need for the Pirates to make this deal unless they were getting someone they liked. So.
Right. So you can speculate and say, okay, well, if Brubaker comes back clean health and he's starting to be active again, they can say, okay, maybe it's conditional. Maybe the player to be named later is somebody a little bit more valuable. But if he's not healthy, if he's not effective, then it's not. So it could be that too.
Yeah, for sure. Sticking with the Pirates, they picked up a very interesting player here. They acquired catcher Joey Bart from the Giants. So Bart we had at 0.5 million in trade value. In exchange, they sent the Giants right-handed pitcher Austin Strickland. He was a recent draft pick and I believe a reliever. We don't have him in the system yet, but tentatively accepted here as a fair trade. Bart we talked about on the last episode. Out of options, former first-round pick, former top prospect. Never got it going at the big league level, never got an extended opportunity because he couldn't earn it for himself. And now he will get that chance in Pittsburgh, which is interesting for another reason that they just seem to not like Henry Davis behind the plate at all. They keep bringing in different options to supplant him as their primary catcher. So that's interesting and something to kind of monitor there as we watch his early career unfold and like whether he should be valued as a catcher going forward or if he's going to be transitioning into this kind of corner outfield, corner infield type. But that's just kind of the domino that I'm seeing falling there. But as far as the Joey Bart of it all, yeah, we all saw this coming all spring that he was going to get. He made the Giants opening day roster as their third catcher, but it was pretty clear from day one that as soon as there was a roster need, he would be the guy to go, and he was, got DFA'd, got traded for a minor league reliever, and that's how his Giants career ends.
You could argue that the Giants waited too long to trade him because his value kept going down and down and down, the longer that time elapsed and his options burned and he wasn't performing and so on. Yeah, you could argue that, but you could also say, well, maybe all the other teams saw it coming too, and they didn't want to overpay for him. And now that his value is at rock bottom, like, fine, okay, we'll give you some random person. So that's basically how it shook out. So I don't know if, I'm sure they were shopping him well before this, but you know, now when push came to shove and they had to get him off the roster, create roster space, then that's all they got. So to your point, I don't think anyone was surprised. I also agree with you about Henry Davis. We often say, watch what front offices do as opposed to what they say. So what they do, it matters, you know, and if they're, you know, if they're basically trying to replace a guy at a position where you thought he was going to play, it means they don't have the confidence that he can play that position. You know, the writing's pretty much on the wall. So, yeah, it's unfortunate because Davis was the number one overall pick. I do think they had hoped that he'd be one of these sort of rare, strong-hitting catchers. Now it's starting to look more and more like, yeah, maybe his bat will play, but I don't know where the glove is going to go at all. It's not clear. So a bit of a man without a home there.
Right. At first with Henry Davis, it looked like, you know, they were trying to exercise his versatility to keep Andy Rodriguez in the lineup, another one of their top prospects who's also a catcher. And so as the stronger defensive catcher, they were hoping to have him back there most of the time. But then he tore his UCL over the winter and he'll be out for the full season. Rodriguez did. And that would seem to open up the path to just say, okay, Henry Davis, you're our starting catcher. But then they had Jason DeLay in the fold. They brought in Ali Sanchez on a minor league deal. And then they signed Yasmani Grandal to a big league deal late in the off season. And so
there you go.
Those are the kinds of moves that are like, do you really have faith in this guy? If you're going to keep bringing in competition, if not full on replacements for the guy at the position. And then now Joey Bart. So interesting. It's something to monitor for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, Henry Davis is no longer a spring chicken. He was drafted out of college, so it's not like, and, you know, as we know, catchers take longer to develop, but at a certain point, you know, you got to kind of cut bait there. So I think that's what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Switching to the Astros now, acquiring infielder Jacob Amaya from the Marlins. We actually had him in the model. We had him on the site listed at 6.7. That was due to a site glitch. We had adjusted him previously and it hadn't gone all the way through. So he should actually be at 2.6, which makes sense because he was DFA'd by the Marlins earlier last week. And so he goes to the Astros. The Marlins receive cash considerations and right-handed reliever, minor league reliever, Valente Belozo. So Belozo not yet in the model. And we kind of just have to have this one as tentatively accepted with Amaya at 2.6 and not entirely sure about the return there. But given that he was DFA'd and given his subpar performance last year, this all tracks for Amaya. And so nothing too out of the ordinary here. It might have looked like it if you hopped on the site the other day and saw, oh, wow, Amaya's at 6.7. What's happening here? But as mentioned, that was a site glitch and he's now been corrected.
Yeah, so occasionally we have our model is in a separate database, and so when we update the model, you know, when we run a general update, you know, the site will update and pick up all the ones from the model, right? And then blah blah blah, magically it's all updated. But you know, when it's sort of in between updates, we do it manually, and so we do that, you know, case 2.6 model, then we're gonna go over into the CMS at the live site and say case 2.6. And for some reason, it doesn't take as well. Sometimes there are glitches. Sometimes it takes a bit. So anyway, that's what happened here. It's fixed now. He's on the Astros at 2.6.
Yep. All right, last couple here. Dodgers acquire Connor Brogdon, right-handed pitcher, $0.7 million in surplus trade value from the Phillies in exchange for left-handed pitcher Benigni Robles, who is not yet in the system. Another one where Brogdon was DFA'd by the Phillies and Robles is not. Not yet in the system, just kind of a fringe minor league prospect, lottery ticket, whatever you want to call him. So this one's also tentatively accepted by the model. And then last one here, the Padres acquiring left-handed pitcher Jackson Wolf at $0.8 million in surplus from the Pirates in exchange for infielder Kervin Pichardo at $0.1. That one is accepted by the model. Wolf is a little bit interesting just because the Padres originally traded him to the Pirates as part of the G-Mon Choi Rich Hill deal that we were kind of scratching our heads about. And now they get him back. So it comes full circle. Do you have any groundbreaking analysis of either of those two earth-shattering transactions?
I do not. Other than the Padres must like Jackson Wolf because they need somebody. He's a warm body. But Josh, you haven't talked about the Diamondbacks trading away Emmanuel Rivera to the Marlins. Should we mention that one?
Should we? Did I miss this one? Was there a player return here?
No, it was just cash. So we had a Rivera at 0.3, and the cash is typically 0.1-ish. So it's fair.
Yeah, he was actually the guy they acquired, and then subsequently DFA'd Jacob Amaya. So there you go. It all comes full circle. All of these early season roster shuffling, 40-man fringe bench deals that are going around. I guess the one bit of additional... one additional point about Emmanuel Rivera is I bet the D-backs wish they hadn't given up on him quite yet, now that Geraldo Perdomo is going to be down for a month, and he could have been some helpful infield depth for them, but he is no longer in the org there, and they've selected Kevin Newman to backfill for Perdomo for now. But the other interesting bit of these is... Brogdon was kind of interesting a couple years ago. He was pretty good for the Phillies in 2022 and just kind of lost it last year. And now he goes to the Dodgers. So is this just another Ryan Brazier? Like, are they going to bring this guy back from the dead too and just keep churning in the bullpen like they do?
They love to resurrect those guys. They just love it. And they continually do a pretty good job at it. So, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah. Well, how's this for a transition? This is one guy they didn't have to resurrect, is catcher Will Smith, whom the Dodgers signed.
He should be a radio DJ.
Oh, yes. I'm great at this. they signed him to a 10-year, $140 million deal. There are some significant deferrals there. There's no opt-outs. It's interesting. So we had this as a pretty... big deal for the Dodgers. Like, they kind of got a steal here. I believe we projected out a 10-year Will Smith extension being closer to like $200 million instead of this $140 million guarantee, let alone the 95-96 ish exactly. number that you get to after the deferrals.
Yeah.
So interesting. And I wonder if this speaks to a larger point about like catcher longevity and expectations from that front, because Will Smith is 29, and so this takes him into his age 39 season, which is kind of insane to think about for a catcher. It's pretty obvious that they're not expecting him to be a fully productive catcher into his age 37, 38, 39 seasons. Like, there's an expectation here that he'll either retire early or move to a different position or whatever. And that this extending the contract out as long as it is kind of a tax dodging type measure of lowering the AAV and their luxury tax hit for the duration of this deal. So even with that acknowledged, though, it seems a bit low. And it reminds me a bit of what we saw with Sean Murphy's extension with the Braves, which was also a bit lower than we expected and also kind of took him into these mid to late 30s as a catcher. So I wonder if there's something there where there's... Yeah. You know, obviously it's wouldn't be surprising to anyone to hear that, oh, hey, people expect catchers to age worse than other positions and more rapidly. But I wonder if there's something more substantial there than even we kind of anticipated that some of these teams are seeing, especially it being the Braves and Dodgers, two of the smarter teams in baseball, making these deals. And, you know, these are two teams that have plenty of money to pay their guys, clearly. And so if they're kind of holding the line at these values, maybe that's indicative of how the market evaluates these catchers as they age.
I totally agree. And this is one of those situations where we didn't have enough data points to make a conclusion, but I think we're starting to. And yeah, if you look at, you know, the Yasmani Grandals and Jonathan Lucroys, who were all-stars in their 20s and not so much in their mid-30s, and they're either retired or the shadow of their former selves. Yeah, clearly there's a lot of wear and tear. We knew that. On the catcher position, but we probably underestimated it to the degree that it falls off in the 30s. And that's, I think, what the Dodgers are pricing into, basically saying Will Smith's going to eventually become a DH. Let's assume, for example, they still love his bat. He's always had the bat. He's never been a great defensive catcher, although he has improved a bit. But yeah, it's if he's 29, he's sending a 10-year deal. He's not behind the plate at age 38, 39. He's going to be DHing. So it's a good call, and we need to adjust for that.
Yeah, and especially when you think about some of the other top catchers recently, like Yadier Molina is the exception to the rule, but a Buster Posey retiring early, you know, Mm-hmm. It looked like he still had some in the tank, but who knows how much was still there. JT Realmuto, who is one of the most athletic catchers we've seen in recent history, and so you'd maybe expect him to be an exception there as well and kind of beat the aging curve. But even he took a pretty substantial step back last year, and, you know, hot start to the 2024 season, but it's been 29 plate appearances. I'm not going to declare that he's fixed and he'll be fine going forward. Like, he might be starting to reach that age as well, and that's at age 32, 33, instead of, you know, 35, 36, when you might expect another star player at a different position to really start feeling their decline. So, yeah, I think there's something here, and it's something to continue to keep an eye on of what age do most of these guys hit a wall. And like I said earlier, it's not going to be this one-size-fits-all thing, but I think you're right to point out guys like Luke Roy just kind of fell off a cliff at around this that point in their career, around the 33, 34 point, where, like, mm-hmm. he was this one of the most underrated players in baseball and just a complete all-around catcher, and then all of a sudden he couldn't block a ball and he couldn't tag out Alex Bregman at home plate in Houston and he couldn't hit the ball with any kind of authority. It was like his bat was waterlogged or something. It just kind of all disappeared overnight without any substantial injury to, like, point to. It just caught up to him, it seemed like.
Yeah, it's just wear and tear from, I mean, playing that position is brutal on the body, right? You're squatting all the time. Maybe even now with the transition to one knee, maybe that'll help a little bit. We'll see. But yeah, the guys who've been doing it the old-fashioned way, yeah, they don't last as long as we thought they would.
Right. Right. So at the end of the day, you know, I think it's a great move by the Dodgers to lock this guy up. It's also good for Will Smith. It's kind of like we said with Murphy, where, you know, there's a lot of risk involved with playing that position. Just kind of talk to Joe Mauer. Obviously, Joe Mauer got his payday, but if he hadn't taken the deal when he did, and you know, everything that happened with his career with the concussions and having to move to first base, like, that's an inherent risk for all of these guys that they're back there every day. You know, it takes one foul ball or one long backswing and it could seriously impact their career going forward. So I certainly don't blame Smith or Murphy or any catcher for taking the money when it's handed to them. And yeah, this is a sizable deal, and he gets to stay in a place where a lot of players want to play. And, you know, it's not the worst deal in the world to say, hey, you get to hang out with Shohei and Yamamoto and the rest of the superstars for the next 10 years. Do you want to sign in? And he says yes.
Yeah, I was just going to make that point. I think there's a bit of a hometown discount here because he probably loves the Dodgers. He wants to be part of the winning team for the next few years. Mookie's there. Shohei's there. Everybody's there. It was like, Muncy took an undervalued deal because they're like, I want to be here. I love it here. So I think there's a bit of that going on too.
Definitely. All right. Last few kind of quick hits. The White Sox brought back Mike Clevinger on a one-year, $3 million deal. He was kind of the last of the MLB quality starting pitchers that were remaining on the free agent market, although that comes with a bit of an asterisk because he has certainly been falling off in the last couple years. But they really just needed warm bodies to fill out the rotation more than anything else with some of the injuries and the trades and everything that they've had there. It's going to be a long season for the White Sox, and yeah, they need somebody to throw some of those innings.
Yeah. And to be fair, there were some, you know, public concerns about off-field issues as well with him. He's got a bit of a checkered past, so that probably helped him. The White Sox get a good deal on him. But I want to kind of take this moment to sort of acknowledge the guys who didn't get signed, the Brandon Belts and quite a few others who were just like waiting, and the call never came, or the offer they thought they would get never came, and so they're still sitting out there without a job. Look, this happens every year, and we know, you know, there are older guys who, you know, the market basically tells them, hey, it's time to retire. They weren't ready for it, but it kind of sneaks up on them, and it's kind of a cold slap in the face to say, hey, I didn't get an offer. Now what? And I'm just sitting here. So, yes, they've made a bunch of money in the past, so, you know, it's not like they're hurting or anything, but still, it's a little bit of a, you know, it doesn't get reported on. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge these guys, like, oh, I've been replaced by a younger version of me, and now what do I do? Because there's another thing that happens. We talked about the trend towards youth more and more, and younger, cheaper is better from the owner's perspective. So more and more we're seeing, you know, we're just going to save a spot on the roster for the young guy, the young guy, the young guy, which means the Brandon Belts of the world are not getting jobs anymore. So that's happening more and more. And just I feel like part of me feels bad for him. Part of me is like, yeah, that's the market. And, but yeah, it can't be great.
Yeah. And Brandon Belt specifically is kind of crazy because he had a 138 WRC plus last year.
Yeah. Why did Justin Turner get a deal? But he doesn't based on.
Yeah. That. Yeah. And like, I understand if you don't believe that all the way, you know, he outperformed his ex WOBA and he is 35, about to turn 36. And he's really a platoon guy only, platoon first base DH. Like, it's hard to. It can be hard logistically to find a spot for that on a roster. I get it, but how is this guy not like an angel or something? Like, he was really good. And then Tommy Pham is a similar story. Like, he had a 110 WRC plus last year. He was pretty solid down the stretch and in the playoffs for the D-backs. And there were discussions kind of late spring, early season with him and the Padres that might happen. And that seemed like a pretty clean fit, but then that kind of went nowhere. So like, what's the deal there? You know, just looking down kind of the remaining free agent list, like, nobody's too shocked that a Donovan Solano or a Matthew Boyd, or as unfortunate as it is, a Zach Greinke or a Rich Hill haven't gotten a contract. Like, you can kind of look at those guys and see, they might have kind of run out of gas there.
they almost overstayed their welcome. Right. Like, they were out of gas before this.
Right. I want nothing more than for a team to sign Greinke and Rich Hill, and I will watch that team for the rest of the season, game in and game out. But I can also understand why that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a whole lot of other, you know, the Brad Hands and Aaron Loops and Manny Pena and Austin Meadows is a different story as well. Yeah. I hope he can catch on somewhere, but a lot of these guys aren't the most surprising. I guess maybe Noah Syndergaard should probably have a minor league deal somewhere, or Kyle Lewis, or, you know, AJ Pollock is on this list. So there's a handful of names here where I wouldn't say the book is closed on them quite yet, whether they're going overseas or catching on a minor league deal or independent ball or whatever and making their way in. But Belt and Pham are two pretty clear outliers where you'd think that you see an injury and maybe they can latch on somewhere on, if not a big league deal, at least a minor league deal with like a clear path to playing time.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about guys who wait out the deadline for the qualifying round. These are not qualifying offer guys. These are just like older, maybe still have a little gas in the tank in terms of productivity kind of guys. But then some of them, no, some should retire. Rich Hill and Zach Greinke should retire. And the market's telling them that.
You take that back. Rich Hill should never retire.
No, I know. I'm with you on that. Like, how long can Rich Hill pitch? You know, how old is he now? 44, 45? I don't know, somewhere up there.
He's definitely in
Bartolo Colon range.
Yeah. Is he really any worse than like half of the options the A's and the Rockies are throwing out there these days?
Yeah, you can make it. He's still got that sort of big sweeping curveball, or does he? I don't know. But anyway,
he can get some outs. But no, I totally get where you're coming from and totally agree that, like, you know, you never, unless they have some big retirement ceremony, and I don't think any of these guys are quite the guy to do it. You know, maybe someday Brandon Belt does the whole one-day contract with the Giants, or, you know, I don't think Greinke is the type to make a big show of it either, just with his kind of unique personality. So you might never hear about some of these guys again, but I'm glad you took a moment here to acknowledge some of these guys. You know, Evan Longoria, he's probably doesn't have a whole lot left to provide a big league team, but he had a very impressive career and he's kind of going out quietly here, it seems like.
Yeah. And this happens every year, obviously. And, you know, it's one of these sort of underreported things like, oh, whatever happened to that guy? He must have retired. Well, it's sort of like, yeah, I wanted to play, but I didn't get the phone call. And so I don't really want to make a big deal about it, but yeah, I'm gone.
Yeah, and some of these guys you might not hear until 3-4 years down the line that they finally announce their retirement, whether bouncing around between leagues or whatever they're doing. So,
or they signed with the Long Island Ducks, and I'm like, oh, yep. Okay.
Yep, that's where Jackie Bradley Jr. just signed there, as well there as, I think, Wei-Yin Chen, if you want another blast from the past. All right, last couple deals here. The Orioles signed Tony Kemp to a big league deal. He was in Reds camp on a minor league contract and didn't make the team. Instead, he goes and joins the Orioles, and they DFA'd Nick Maton to make room for him, which was kind of interesting because I would picture Maton as just like a younger Kemp. But Kemp's a great clubhouse guy, just one of the better guys in the game. So glad to see him catch on there.
He got a job.
Yep. The Mets sign Julio Teheran, which is this keeps happening. I feel like it's been like 3 or 4 years in a row where some reason Julio Teheran just gets passed around the teams that need a warm body to throw some innings.
Is he the new Edwin Jackson? Like 13, kinda. 14 teams.
It really feels like it. Because yeah. At one point he was, you know, one of the best young pitchers in the game. And then everything pretty much fell apart pretty quickly after that. But he's really just been hopping around the league like this. And there's always these random, like, it's always a John Heyman, like, breaking news tweet that feels so out of place of, like, there was this discourse for a while with the Padres a year or two ago where they were, like, trying to sign Teheran and couldn't, if I remember correctly. I don't know. But he's on the Mets now. Good for them. They needed innings covered. Yeah. And then last one I have here, just a correction from last time. I said that the Twins signed Jesse Chavez to a big league deal. That was a mistaken report, apparently. And he actually, surprise, surprise, goes back to the Braves on a minor league deal because time is a flat circle. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, he's 40, right? So, yeah, I don't know if there's anything left in that tank, but good for them.
If there's anyone who can get it out, it's the Braves, because he's a different guy in that uniform, apparently.
Yeah, right.
Well, all right. I think we've covered pretty much everything. Is there anything else that we missed?
So on that sort of related, on a related note, we've been cleaning up the kind of the back ends of each team's roster on the site. Guys who didn't, like minor leaguers who were kind of in the system but never really made it. And at a certain point, they lost their jobs too. So, you know, we're cleaning that up. Like, oh, this guy's not on the Orioles anymore or whatever. So we're going through sort of literally name by name saying, is he still on the roster? Yes or no? If no, yeah, you'll see the change. So just a heads up, just a little housekeeping. So.
Yep. If you see anyone hanging around on the wrong team, shoot us a tweet, shoot us an email. We'll get that fixed.
Absolutely.
Well, cool. As mentioned earlier in the episode, also feel free to send us ideas for episode 100 coming up very soon, within the next month or so. We'll see how the scheduling works out with some of these spring, summer trips that John and I may have planned. But yeah, otherwise, that'll do it for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to shoot us an email at baseballtradevalues@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @baseballvalues. Also, be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. We'll be back in a couple weeks to break down more news and updates. So until then, stay safe and enjoy the season. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Josh.